arrived. I'm calling to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Davids, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chairman, I move the minutes of February 2nd.
Representative Davids moves the minutes of February 2nd. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, today we have a the University of Minnesota is continuing its presentation, and they, in your packet, there is also information that was requested at the last meeting. So if Ms. Tolleson and Mr. Franz would come up. And then I think before we get into the capital part of this, Budget Director Tolleson, I think you're going to go over some tuition data for us.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. We were asked
to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Julie Tonneson, I'm the budget director for the University of Minnesota. And we were asked at the hearing last week to provide information related to tuition rates by campus and what they would be under a particular model. So as requested, we have provided a model of what the tuition rate increases and the corresponding tuition rates would be for each campus under the planning assumptions that President Gabel discussed last week, which was a 3.5% increase for tuition rates on the Twin Cities campus and a 1% increase for tuition rates on each of our system campuses. And just to emphasize, none of these are a done deal, so to speak. The Board of Regents does not vote on our tuition rates until June of each year. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions about the information provided, Mr. Chair.
Budget Director Tolleson, this also would not happen unless you got your full budget request?
Mr. Chair, this is a model we're currently working with, assuming we get the full request, yes.
And Ms. Tolleson, can you explain why there's a difference in tuition here and why there's a difference in tuition increases by campus?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, over time, we have worked to try to create a larger differential between the Twin Cities campus tuition rates and each of our system campus tuition rates. And each year, the chancellors bring forward their proposal for tuition rate changes, given all of the variables that they are working with to balance their budgets. And so in different years, some of them might have been zero, some might have been 1% or 1.5%, and so forth. And that's how they get that slight difference between the system campuses. But it has been a conscious effort to create a larger difference between the Twin Cities campus and the system campuses over time.
So I'm looking at the numbers, and given the data that we received with the declining enrollment, does declining enrollment have any impact on what you're going to do with the tuition increase?
Mr. Chair, the enrollment demand does factor in every year in terms of along with other variables as we consider what tuition rate increases to implement. So yes, it does have an impact on the ultimate recommendation to the board.
And Ms. Tolleson, why wasn't this given to us at the beginning when you did your overall budget presentation?
Mr. Chair, members, sorry, we didn't know that this information would be helpful or useful in this format.
Yeah, I think it's been a decade since anyone asked for it. So in the future, I would highly recommend giving us this type of detail, particularly when we're looking at the enrollment decline that's going on with these other campuses. And I say that because I think it helps us understand your problem and better helps us, hopefully, give you the resources to address the problem.
So, thank you.
Any questions, members? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for providing this. I'm just confused, and it might be because I'm a new member, so please excuse me if it's just my misunderstanding. But we talked about the increases at the different campuses, and I was under the impression from that conversation that Rochester and Twin Cities were going to absorb most of that. But when I look at this, it looks like Morris's increase is the same as Rochester's, and at the end of the day, the tuition is within a couple of dollars, even though kind of what we've talked about, sort of the differences between those two universities, I was sort of under the impression that Rochester was going to see a bigger increase and Morris was going to see less. So I'm confused.
Ms. Townsend.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the planning assumptions that we've put together for modeling purposes right now assume a 1% increase for each of the system campuses, including Rochester. That's a planning assumption. As I mentioned earlier, the chancellors have the ability to bring forward a proposal for different tuition rate increases, and we have heard from the Rochester chancellor that they believe the demand for their programming may help them increase it beyond the 1% that we are currently planning.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's great demand in Rochester. I think there's a lot of commitment to that campus. I think it attracts folks in a different way. But when I think about the facilities at Rochester, right, you're leasing and remodeling a gorgeous hotel as dorm rooms. And then I think about Morris. I'm confused by these numbers being so close, given that I think Rochester is kind of incentivized by what it is so much. So it would cost the same to go to either facility based on these numbers.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, members, these are the tuition rates only. So housing, if you want to think about housing, is a different rate and a different charge. But for tuition rates, I think it's also important to remember that Rochester has been in a growth mode. And so as we have been trying to increase the campus enrollment and grow them to their desired levels, they came in at the beginning at the same levels as our other system campuses rather than the Twin Cities. So they kind of started at that lower base and have been increasing, as I mentioned, based on the chancellor's recommendations, in a growth mode at a little bit lower rate than the Twin Cities.
Ms. Townsend, given that comment, then wouldn't Morris be in a declining mode and therefore their tuition and an incentive to get students, wouldn't that be going down?
Mr. Chair, members, it's a decision every year on whether or not to increase tuition to hold it flat. It's difficult to balance the budget by reducing tuition when you don't have any other revenue to make up that change. And so it has been very difficult to entertain that as an option, but they certainly have increased at very low, some years zero and some years very low amounts. And they have worked really hard to build more student aid to pull down the net price for the students that have a financial need.
This committee has at times given you the resources to do just that,
yeah,
to hold tuition flat, and I think there may be an argument to go another direction now. So again, the level of detail here, I would really appreciate in all presentations to the committee. A generic 3.5, this is much different than a generic 3.5 tuition increase. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the data. Any further questions, members? Representative Poole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we'll see if this turns into a question or not, but I guess to that point, I understand obviously the for lack of a better term, sort of the cost inputs, but I mean, Morris's enrollment has declined by almost half in the last decade, and obviously there's a reason I'm not in higher education administration and I'm sitting at this table instead, but to me that suggests that, I mean, some of the costs that tuition funds would not be there when your enrollment declines by almost half. So I guess, and we don't need to take up any more time on this, but I guess it would just help me to understand a little bit how, if enrollment has declined by half, how tuition has stayed at that sort of similar level. The one side isn't adding up to the other side in my mind. But we can maybe come back to that at a later date. Thank you.
I appreciate the observation, and hopefully if the governor's people are listening, they're learning something too today. All right, I think we'll turn it over to Vice President France.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Myron France, Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. See if I can run the slides, and I can. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and Ranking Member O'Neill, and members of the committee for this opportunity to talk about the capital request from the university. This slide is designed to give you a bird's eye view of the overall campus condition of the various campuses in terms of those facilities are in poor or critical condition, those that are fair or below average, and those are that are in excellent or good condition. You can see it obviously varies across campuses, and the total for the system at the bottom there shows that we have 32 million square feet of space, 8.8 million is in poor or critical condition, 13 billion would be the total replacement value, and we have a $5.1 billion 10-year renewal need. That is increased by about $1 billion over the last 10 years. So this shows us the opportunities that we have, and because one of the things we really want our talented team to do at the university is really assess critically where are the conditions of the building, what needs to be addressed, and how do we keep up with the demands, because we want to make sure that we provide the right programming, but the programming has to be conducted in a facility that's up to date. Part of the issue, as we have experienced, is delay causes problems. And just this last month at the Regional Fitness Center on the Morse campus, a leaking skylight caused some moisture to build up, which led to the failure where a section of the ceiling fell into the pool. That thankfully no one was injured, but clearly that pool is used by the community, not just the university. And it's a warm water pool with an accessible entry, with people with a wide range of physical abilities, including those for rehabilitation purposes. So these things happen on a 32 million square foot footprint, and we have to be concerned about that. I want to mention one other issue about the delay. Delay causes not only those kinds of issues, but also increased cost. The chemistry teaching project that I'll be talking about momentarily, the total project cost in 2020 was $98.4 million. That's when we first presented this building and this idea to the legislature for funding. And had that been funded at that time, we'd be finishing the construction this fall. But now, today, the total project cost is estimated at $138.9 million. This is using Minnesota Management and Budget inflation estimates. So timing has been a real source of problem for that particular project. As you know, a lot of issues have come up with construction and supply chain issues, but now the three-year delay means that several classes of undergrads from every college on the Twin Cities campus will not be able to benefit from this building. So we're really supportive of this building, but it just shows again the cost of delay. The university really only has two real sources for facility renewal. One of them is the state bonding projects that you approve, and the other one is the university's operating general budget. Now, if we don't receive funding from the legislature for HEPR, Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement, if we don't receive funding for that, then we have to find other ways, either through tuition or through the appropriation from the legislature, to make those changes. One of the things that clearly the failure to keep up in addressing these issues is that underfunding will eventually cause problems, and when problems arise and you don't plan for them, they're much more expensive. But let's talk a little bit about the about the renewal investments. This is really our projection of where we should be going. It shows you since 2013 through 2022 the target renewal range. Our facility condition assessment inspections, they do inspections, they study, and they model to tell us where to put the funds. This chart shows that the university, in partnership with the state, has been able to invest in some years more than others, obviously. The bottom yellow range shows the minimum annual investment needed just to maintain the status quo. You see the minimum.
Friends, I think we've got a question. Representative Scott.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franz, I have a question that, as a newbie on this committee, and I don't know the answer to this, and I know that's a dangerous thing to do, is to ask the question without knowing the answer around here, but what responsibilities does the University of Minnesota have for keeping its own buildings in good repair? Is that all the state's responsibility? Is that supposed to be shared by the university? Is there a concrete answer to that question?
I have a partial answer for it, and I'm quoting Representative Lyndon Carlson, who was incensed during a capital investment committee hearing when the systems were promoting new buildings, and there was no mention of Heber at all. And then he insisted that Heber become the number one priority for both systems, that you should be repairing and replacing before building new. And that's an interesting balance that higher ed tries to maintain, and sometimes does and sometimes does not. So they're supposed to do the replacement and repair first before they get the shovel for breaking the ground.
And so, Mr. Chair, so is that responsibility just the university, or is that shared with the state? Is there a percentage? What?
It should be the responsibility of the committees that do the funding to say, we want the higher education asset preservation and repair first. And you'll notice that I asked for a breakdown by campus here, and we're going to get to that discussion too. Given our discussion of declining enrollment and other things, the priority becomes more and more Heber and making sure these buildings are in tip-top condition, that things aren't falling into the pool, that roofs aren't falling down in certain auditoriums. All of that should be taken into consideration first.
Okay,
so I'm just quoting Lyndon Carlson.
Safe enough. Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
If you look at this chart, we're trying to give ourselves some guidance in terms of what we need to be planning for. And it's our belief that $200 million request that we made this year would be the figure that would keep us on track to keep up with this, with the number of asset preservation problems that we have. You know, one of the things that I've got a number here that tells you a little bit about that number I'm looking for. I think in the building trade, they say about $10 of investment equals about how many dollars of?
Give me a second, I'll find the answer.
So here we're showing the slide that shows you how much Heber we've gotten, to your question, Representative, about over the last number of years. And you can see only in three of the last few years have we gotten any Heber whatsoever. And the it's only met about 7% of our requests have been granted through the Heber process through the legislative process. I want to talk a little bit about how do we focus on
3-to-1 payback.
3-to-1. So every $3 invested
for every dollar we invest, we save
three. So every dollar we invest in Heber, for example, we save $3 in future costs. So that's why. When we see these big investments in Heber, we see our overall need come down because we're really reducing and eliminating some of that future cost. Here, let's talk a little bit about what we do at the university and how much of our university is place-based. I mean, obviously, we need classrooms and research laboratories, libraries, healthcare, residential, and all these issues, functions on the left, you can see, are core to our mission. Our office space is about 21.5% currently of the 32 million square feet that I mentioned earlier. If we've learned anything through COVID, it's that we can use our office space differently than we used to before, and more effectively and more efficiently. So our focus is really being able to try to utilize our office space in a way that it maximizes that use. In fact, the administration currently, my office, the president's office, is located in Morrill Hall, just right next to Northrop Auditorium, and we're planning to move out of Morrill Hall to other space so that we can redesign Morrill Hall to be student-facing space, to have more student-facing activities right on the core of campus. If people want to come to the University of Minnesota, we want to make sure that we provide them with the right assets and the right opportunity in the core of the campus to engage in those activities. One of the things,
Vice President Franz, Representative O'Neill has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice President Franz. It's nice to see you in a different role.
We've
had many conversations in the past in a different role. I have a specific question about this slide, and you have residential on here, and I know that the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus had a significant issue with black mold in their dormitories. You know, this goes right to the Heber question. How did that happen? When you have black mold, that's a continuing problem for many, many years, typically, to build up to that point. You've got moisture, you've got problems like that, you have ventilation problems. I don't know if it was the same dorm, but I've actually been in the dorms when I was visiting my daughter, and I was
you know, when I went to Minn State campus, so my dorms were great compared to what they had. It was just really, it was more like a prison I had visited prior. So I'm just wondering what happened. Why is there mold in the dormitories?
Vice President Friends.
Mr. Chair and Representative, great question, and one that I asked too. And we've asked that building, that's the 17th Avenue facility on University. And I think it came online in 2014 is what I want to say. And so we had the same issue. And so one of the things we did immediately was, with our health and safety team, was to go in there and inspect what was the problem. Was it a design problem? Was it a materials problem? Was it an installation problem? And so our team is analyzing that, working with the contractors to come up with a solution. It was fairly easy to resolve by going in there and taking out that materials and replacing the materials with new new paint and new materials. Some kind of moisture had developed there, but we're working on the design. Why did that happen? So when those things happen like that, for example, when the Northrop Auditorium, the roof didn't collapse. The roof is fine. It's the parapet walls that go along the side that hold up the roof. Well, those happen to be original to the building, almost 100 years old. So, you know, a lot of pressure on those. So we're looking now to how do you redesign those parapet walls in the future so we don't have that same problem again. So whenever something like that happens, whether it's mold or if it's a roof issue, we first thing we do is make sure we design, understand the design and analyze what really happened and can it be fixed and should it have happened or not. Sometimes it's just a 100-year-old roof, but sometimes it's not. And on the mold case, we're analyzing that with our engineers quite carefully.
Thank you, Mr.
Proceed. As I mentioned, we were able to free up some lease space. One of the things we're doing, the university has leased space over the years, and now with our reduced need for office space, we're trying to make sure that we reduce the lease space that the university has to make sure that we're using only that space that's owned by the university to further reduce costs. So it's an ongoing analysis to make sure that we are renewing those places that need renewal. For example, the mechanical engineering building several years ago was a great old building in the middle of campus, but it needed complete new infrastructure and the heating and cooling and facilities on the inside. And so we used HEPR money for some of that. We used some other funds. We were able to completely redo that building, much like we did with Pillsbury Hall, for those of you who have been in Pillsbury. And that building is now operational in the core of campus. We avoided building a new building by fixing the ones that we have. That is our objective in many, many cases. And in fact, that's what we want to do with Morrill Hall. We think we can turn that into a really great facility for student activities. And besides, people don't care where the administration offices are so much. And so it's a great opportunity for us to really allow the student spaces to come forward. Here's the capital request that we've made this year. It shows you we've asked $200 million for the HEPR system. We've asked for $138.9 million from the state. As you can see here, about a third of that price will be borne by the university. So on new projects, the university typically supports a third of the new construction. We also have the farm project, the Agricultural Research and Education Complex, for a total of $120 million, $60 million from the state. We're asking for some design money for the Duluth Academic Health Sciences. I'm going to go through each one of these in a little bit more detail. And then we have two projects, one at Crookston and one at Morris, to show the full reach of the HEPR, of the project request around the entire campus. But let's go back. HEPR is the number one priority. These are the kinds of projects that HEPR is used for: accessibility, health and safety, the mold system that you mentioned, Representative, building systems, infrastructure, energy efficiency. These are the kinds of things that they may not be glamorous and we may not have a ribbon cutting, but they're really important for these buildings to get done and for the students to access these. We want to make sure that the buildings are safe, functional, and welcoming to our students and to our faculty and staff who work there.
Vice President Franz, I want to go to the breakdown by campus of HEPR for a second.
And you have that handout, Mr. Chair?
The detailed handout by campus. If you don't get your $200 million, the governor's was how much was the governor's allocation?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was $170 million.
170. So how is that broken down by campus? Which campus gets what if you get 170?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we can give you that chart. So what we would do then is we would take this chart and back out the 30-some million dollars and try to spread it around. The HEPR allocation is designed to make sure every campus gets its fair share. I mean, part of it's really need. It goes to where it's needed the most, but it's also distributed based upon the actual footprint of the campus.
So I'm going to just press you a little bit by campus here. Are these HEPR recommendations ranked by priority? So if I go to Crookston, the number one would be their number one priority. I realize the numbers on the side just go all the way down. But so Duluth, would the mechanical then be their number one priority and so on down the line?
Mr. Chair, they're not ranked in priority order. They're ranked in my priority order as all number one. I mean, it's really hard to do what you're asking, and we'll do it if we have to. I mean, that's the nature of this process, but we would – part of this is the criticality. Is a system near failure? It's going to get to the top of the list. If it's going to affect a larger number of students, it'll get to the top of the list. So how long has it been on the list as part of it? How long do we think it's going to last? How long is the roof? I mean, that's part of the thing you have to make. There's a couple of roofs on here, right? Let me see if I can find one. Well, look down number 16 and 17, roof replacement. Well, that's a real guess. Well, let's take those two off of Duluth. Well, if we do, what if we guess wrong? Then that's a major, major problem. So we'll make that decision if we're forced to, but we're hoping that we get the full $200 million so we don't have to make that choice.
I've got Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. I'm just a little confused, so if you'll help me figure this out. So in the campus condition slide, it doesn't have a number. The Morris campus is 50% in bad condition, right? And your statement of every campus to get their fair share, but Morris, it looks like on this is just $5 million of the total 200. It just seems to me like I'm not sure which is the chicken or the egg. I think that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is the poor condition of the campus driving the low enrollment? Is it the fact that we're raising tuition 1%? Is that going to be that we've already outpriced our students? I'm just trying to figure it out. So if that campus is at 50% bad condition, right, is the $200 million the number we need, or should that number actually be higher? I'm just trying to get to the point of what is the real need as opposed to the ask, right? And so I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but how do you square that condition of that campus and then they have the smallest request? And I know there are serious demands all across our system, but.
Vice President Frank.
Mr. Chair, Representative. No, it's a really good question. I went ahead here to put the slide up about the allocation, the actual allocation per campus. You know, you make those decisions. Part of the way we're able to make it, as a slide before I showed where we've only gotten HEPR in three out of the last number of years, part of the reason we're able to get by with that is that we have really talented people who work at the university to maintain these buildings. You know, you do what you can to keep the building going. You have a roof leak, well, you fix it, and instead of replacing it, you fix it again. We did not have the Northrop Auditorium roof on our list, right? So things happen. We would rather engage in more accelerated HEPR if we could, but part of what we're trying to do is let the people at the local campuses manage their facilities. That's why we put a specific request for a Morris project and a Crookston project on here to show that they actually have, we wanted to elevate those off of the HEPR list onto the regular project list. Now, in Rochester, because we lease the buildings down there, that's taken care of through the lease agreements, and we don't ask for HEPA for those. But it's really difficult to make these kind of choices. I mean, we could easily spend $400 million, if that's what you're saying, and we know exactly where the priorities are. But a lot of this involves guesswork and talented people maintaining these facilities beyond what they should last, because we have talented people doing that.
Representative Cleburne.
No, I would just, you know, honor the responsibility of the legislature in this too, in that your slide that shows you've asked and it was not forthcoming. You know, I think we need to consider, Mr. Chair, this systemic disinvestment that we've made in these campuses and trying to figure out how we right this ship. Thank you.
Well, Representative Cleburne, that's why we're doing it again in this committee and in capital investment. So that we have a firm understanding in both committees what the needs are here. And I am hopeful that we will be able to make a sizable commitment to both systems, particularly in HEPA. Representative O'Neill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm looking at the original document with listing each campus and each individual project with the total, I'm wondering if at some point I could see sort of the source data behind that number, as in your budget, your bids, are you doing RFPs, who's going to be doing the work, is it going to be internal, are you going to hire contractors from outside? Because it's one thing to just have, you know, a number on a paper, but I used to work in an accounting firm, and I kind of like to see, I mean, I've done accounting work and audits, and I'd like to see sort of the original data of how you've arrived at this. I'm just wondering if you could provide that at some time. I'm not asking for it right now, obviously, but and I don't mean for every single project, but it would be nice to pick out 2-3 just so I can really process through that sort of information. Also, you had mentioned a couple times now about the Morris campus and that the ceiling fell into the pool, but it was stemming from a lighting issue. On the spreadsheet that we have for the Morris campus, can you tell me which of those listed here is on, you know, how does that relate? Is it the number 22, 23, 24? Which of those is that project?
I'll need some help for that one, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Okay.
And I might just say, you know, on the accounting, one of the things that we do is a lot of these are estimates, because we don't really get the bids until we get the money. So we can only go so far, but we have some bigger projects that we can show you the analysis that we went through to project those. We'll get that for you.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Brian Swanson with University Services. The Morris question you're asking about in particular, we're working to get that one done now with borrowing some money out of Twin Cities HEPA funds we had left over from a previous appropriation, rather than wait and have the pool have to wait until the end of session. So we're trying to solve that one now with older funds.
Sure. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then also it would be noted that, you know, I was just looking back at our previous spreadsheet that we had in a previous committee, and the direct appropriations for an O&M, operations and maintenance, was in the tails, it's $1.3 billion, well, almost $1.4 billion. And can you just help remind me what's your total overall operating budget and how much the state of Minnesota provides for that, so that we know, since that's supposed to be for operations and maintenance, you know, there's money in there for maintenance. So,
yeah,
Mr. Chair, I'll ask a budget director Thompson to come up, but I will say that the operating budget's a little about $4.2 or $4.3 billion, but she can give that.
Budget Director Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. Our total budget, all funds, is for the current year is $4.2 billion, and the state appropriation is 17% of that total.
Mm-hmm. Representative O'Neill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, typically, it's about 18%, so we're kind of right there. So they're out of their total budget. I think it's duly noted. It should be noted that the state of Minnesota provides now 17% of that. And we do provide it for operations and maintenance is literally what it's for. So I'm just want to make sure we all know that, because we have lots of newbies on this committee. There's just a few of us that have been here before, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was actually going to be one of my questions, because I was looking back to our budget presentation from the University of Minnesota, and we have the revenue sources chart, but I look through there, but we don't have any of the expenses and how those expenses. That's, I was very interested in knowing that percentage. I didn't know that. And Mr. Chair, I was curious about the previous testifier, the gentleman that said that there were leftover fund, HEPR funds that they're using to address this pool issue. And I'm wondering, do we have information on how some sort of an accounting of unused HEPR funds? It sounds to me like there shouldn't be any unused HEPR funds if their demand is so great and we have so many issues.
Vice President Franz.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, well, they're temporarily. So we spend every dollar of HEPR. In fact, we report to the legislature every year of the amount of money that we've spent. And so this would just be because it's there temporarily, and we could replace it with new HEPR that is coming through the legislature this year, we hope. So we always spend every dollar of HEPR. Let me just add, too, on this chart, it shows some of the O&M money that we use to spend on repair and replacement. So if you see this chart, the yellow repair and replacement, that comes from our O&M budget from the state. The HEPR comes from our direct HEPR appropriation from the legislature. And then the asset reinvestments, they're like the Pillsbury haul that we did together. So those show you the three different buckets of kind of dealing with the capital projects. But there is a component that comes from the O&M budget, and that's the yellow right there. Mr. Chair, anything else?
Thank you.
Before?
I think you're ready to proceed.
I think so.
Representative Noor, did you have a question? Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice President. I'm trying to understand number 157, which is the Washington Avenue Bridge, which is used by my constituents and also the students. When was the last time that we invested on that pedestrian bridge? And I know that's a huge asset, not only for the U, but also for the community surrounding the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't know the last time we did. It's been a while. One of the things we're concerned about, not only the look of that, because you get up close, it looks fine from a ways when you can see the colors, but there's a lot of wear and tear on that building, and both in terms of the amount of people that use it, the safety elements of that. So our real concern is that we need to make a commitment to that bridge because it is used so much. And we haven't thought about that. After the light rail went on down below and all that redone was completed, it's now time for us to think about that top section, how we can make that really much more functional. We think it's a critical component to the East and West Bank, and we really want to pursue that one very soon.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll follow up on that. Thanks.
So if we look at I wanted to give you an example. The list is the best example, as Chair Pulaski has pointed out. The list shows you exactly how we would spend the $200 million. This just shows you some of the bigger projects. For example, in the Crookston campus, the natural gas distribution lines, those lines are now, they're steel piping over 40 years old. And corrosive nature of that soil up there has caused some corrosion and leakage, so we want to make sure that is replaced. That's a really important project. On the Duluth campus, the business school annex, there we want to do the HVAC and some code renewals, some safety code renewals on a building that's been around for a long time. On the Morris campus, the Briggs Library, that was built in the late 1960s. There's no automatic fire sprinkler system there, and we need some ADA accessible restrooms, so they're a really important project there. And then Twin Cities campus, the food science and nutrition building was built in 1956, and we need to do some mechanical systems in that building. So there are a lot of big projects, and there are a lot of small projects around the system that keep us busy to make sure that the HEPR gets used by all campuses in a way that we allocate, as we were talking earlier, we allocate under this formula to make sure that every campus gets some of the funds and on $200 million appropriation. I'd like to go through the individual projects, unless there's any other questions about HEPR before we dive into that.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask, so when we talk about the funding of the University of Minnesota for operations and maintenance, our charts only go back so far. So while this conversation was going on, I asked, what was our appropriation in 1990. So we have a bigger view of what was the funding for the university, and the answer I received back was 39%. So we're at 18% today, and in the 1990s, we were at 39%. So are we fulfilling our obligation to Minnesotans? I don't know, but I think it's a very good conversation for us to have as this committee moves forward.
Representative Cleburne, while you're asking that question, you might want to find out what the salary of the president of the University of Minnesota was in 1990 compared to today.
We can have a whole host of conversation around all kinds of topics, but I'm just talking about us as a legislature and our need to make sure that we are truly serving our state and the state's economy. And that University of Minnesota is an important driver for innovation in our state, and it returns billions of dollars into our economy every year, and I just don't want that to get lost in the conversation of we're doing enough. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne, when you're using those numbers, remember some of the differential, a good part of the differential, is made up by tuition increases.
I know, right.
And that is, I think, now part of our problem with enrollment.
Well, and my concern is that when we are raising tuition on students this year, and I'll just say the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, that 3.5% that these students in this window of 4 years will pay, or this window of 1 year will pay, is really the result of costs that have been accruing long before they got there. So we're asking students today to pay the burden from a time they weren't even there. And to me, that just doesn't seem fair to our students, and we need to figure this out together, collectively, all of us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to talk about the chemistry undergraduate teaching laboratory. This chemistry project has been before this legislature several times. It was funded for design back in 2020 for $3.3 million. We are ready. This is a shovel-ready project, I assure you. Those of you who have had the opportunity to tour the facility have seen the old chemistry building. It was from the 1920s. The current labs are really way out of date. And if you've not had a chance to tour the building, I'm happy to set up that opportunity or to try to talk to some of the students who use that. This project desperately needs to be funded this session. The cost just keeps going up, and there's virtually every college in the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus have students that go through the chemistry, take a chemistry course and go through this building. And you know, one of the things that our competition is out there. One of the things that University of Wisconsin built just recently was a $130 million chemistry project of their own. So, you know, we do have to compete in some ways as well, but this one is way beyond the need. And this is taking the old Fraser building, the law school building, Fraser Hall, and repurposing that and adding on to it. So once again, we're not just building an entirely new structure. We're trying to use what's there and add on to it in a way that makes the most sense. So we're really very excited about this project. The next one you've heard about, I believe, the Agricultural Research and Education Complex, FARM, with two A's. This one is really, as you know, Minnesota is a global leader in agriculture and food systems, and the University of Minnesota has been a real partner in that. One of the things to be able to deliver on these results are the 10 research and outreach centers we have across the state. Many of you are aware of those. But these research and outreach centers need to have significant modernization and investment if we're going to continue to advance Minnesota's agricultural status in this country and in the state of Minnesota. So we're requesting $60 million from the state to be matched by a $60 million pledge from the Hormel Foundation. This $120 million investment would allow the university to advance the first phase of what will eventually be a $220 million project. FARM represents the opportunity to create a state-of-the-art integrated research facility that ties animal agriculture and crop systems research together in a way that recognizes how agriculture, food, the environment, and human health operate as one system. Now, and this is in partnership with the Riverland Community College in Austin. FARM represents a vertical educational opportunity that includes K through 12, two-year technical degrees, bachelor's, as well as graduate degrees, and community outreach. The farm project, when completed, will contribute $18 million in direct economic impact and $33 million in total annual economic impact. This does not include the typical $40 to $1 economic return attributed to agriculture R&D in Minnesota.
Vice President Franz, you mentioned Riverland in Austin. Is Hormel part of that also?
Mr. Chair, yes. Hormel is one of our partners. They've pledged to invest $60 million. This is the largest pledge we've received, and they are an integral part of this project.
And I believe you also have a relationship with Hormel with the Cancer Institute also in Austin?
With the what is?
The Cancer Institute.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that the Hormel Institute is one of those hidden gems. We shouldn't hide it as much as we do. It's a tremendously great institution with a lot of great cancer research going on, and we look forward to the combination of human research, the agricultural research, and the work with Riverland and the Hormel Institute in that community.
I've toured both, and it's extremely impressive what they're doing, and also on the K-12 level. We'll hear a little bit of that in the joint hearing that we're having on the 14th.
Good, thank you. On the Duluth Academic Health Sciences, we're asking for design money, $12 million in state funding. This would be to design approximately 180,000 square foot facility in the Duluth Medical District. Many of you may remember, I forget how many years it's been now, that the Duluth Medical District was designed and supported by the legislature to help Essentia and St. Luke's build and enhance their facilities. If you've been in Duluth lately and you've seen the new Essentia building, it's quite impressive, and as well as St. Luke's has added some impressive building of their own on the other side. The Duluth Medical District sits with those two systems in Duluth, and what we would like to do is build our Duluth Academic Health Science Center in the middle of that academic and health science center. This project would expand our regional teaching and research space in Duluth. It would allow the medical and pharmacy programs to students to come down from the UMD campus to this facility in the Duluth Medical District to participate in this healthcare research and education. It's an incredible opportunity for the city of Duluth, who's a big supporter of this. Initial studies call for anywhere from 180,000 to 200,000 square foot. And we think this would be one of the great ways that the university's academic health center could expand its reach into greater Minnesota and previously underserved communities in that area. So we're very excited about this opportunity in Duluth. I want to mention two local projects, Crookston, the heating plant and utility infrastructure. I had the opportunity to tour this about 3 or 4 months ago. This project is one really very essential. We know that we need reliable furnaces in the Minnesota winter. This Crookston heating plant was built in 1911 and serves the entire campus. It has about 40 buildings and about 500,000 square feet. The funding would be used primarily to address the aged and deteriorated equipment inside the campus heating plant. The University of Minnesota Crookston relies on one 40-year-old boiler with an emergency backup propane boiler to heat the campus. The heating plant needs a significant investment to address issues with everything from the smoke stack to the electrical panels. Certain parts essential to the operation of the plant are only available now on eBay, as some of the original suppliers are no longer in business. So we really cannot rely on available parts much longer. So this is a really important opportunity. It's a HEPA quality project, but this is one we felt the need to ask specifically for this particular project. Just like the next one at Morris, the multi-ethnic resource center improvements, this center was constructed in 1899. And it's the only campus building original to the Native American boarding school. Since 1972, though, the building has been home to the Office of Equity, Diversity, and Intercultural Programs. This building lacks an elevator and other basic accessibility infrastructure, as well as modern life safety and building systems. Funding this would help us install an elevator and make other essential building improvements. The folks at Morris are very excited about that opportunity. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've run through the projects and the HEPA that we've requested from the state. We look forward to your questions, and we look forward to your support, and can provide any additional information that you would like.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice President.
So the glaring omission I see is no discussion of purchasing the university medical facilities back from the Sanford Health, which I understand could be upwards of $1 billion. So could you help us understand where that fits into this capital request?
Vice President Franz.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. So right now we're in the process of working on the design of this our five-point plan for the Academic Health Center in Minneapolis. And the first part of that plan is to make sure that we support and establish the academic health system at the University of Minnesota. Now, part two of that is to reacquire some of the flagship assets. And I'll come back to that to address your particular issue. The third part of that five-point plan is to redesign some of the partnerships we have with health systems in the community and across the state. The university needs to have health systems to work with. We need the patients, and we need to have our doctors and nurses and pharmacists practicing out there. So the integrated partnership is critical. The fourth part of that five-point plan is to design ultimately a state-of-the-art hospital in the next 5 to 10 years on the east bank near the clinics and surgery center, where we've already purchased the land. And number five of that five-point project is to enhance some of the current buildings we have to get us to that new hospital. We're not looking to build new beds. We need to make sure that we keep these beds operational and up to modern requirements until we build that new hospital. But going back to point number two, in 1997, when the East Bank Hospital was transferred to Fairview, it was a complicated arrangement where the building use was required to be continued to be used in advance of the Minnesota mission, University of Minnesota mission of academic health practice. And so that building continues to be, as a requirement, as a public asset, has to be used in furtherance of that project or that purpose. So when that happened, there was money exchanged hands both from University and Fairview, but there were a lot of obligations going both ways. So we do think that the transfer of that particular hospital back to the university is an important step in this process. But we're still working on what does that transfer look like back. It's a reacquisition, if you will, of a hospital that was used by the university and now being used by a 501c3. So it has to continue to be used for that purpose. So it's not like the sale of a normal building. So if I sold you a car and you gave me $20,000 for my car and I gave you the title, you could do what you wanted with that car. When this hospital was transferred, there were a lot of rights and obligations that went with that facility as part of that new agreement. So we're working on uncovering that original agreement to see how that building should be transferred back. The West Bank Hospital was originally part of the Fairview system, and the Masonic Children's Hospital was later built with a lot of support by the university, especially in fundraising for that. And the clinics and children's center is currently owned by the university. So it's a complex legal and analysis that we're going through. But our goal ultimately is to have the university own and operate its own academic health system, but at the same time have a partnership with other community health systems to work with that system so that we have a seamless distribution of our academic health medicine into the community. Because it doesn't do us, well, it does some people some good, but the key mission for the university is to make sure that everyone in Minnesota benefits from their academic health development of innovative care and new treatments. And you can only do that through a great care delivery system. So I hope I addressed your question a little bit.
Thank you. That was actually very helpful. I've not heard most of that discussion of the five-point plan. But it still begs the question, will you be asking for an additional capital project tied to this biennium? Or, you know, how does that fit into your request? Thank you.
Vice President Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not trying to dodge the question. I think the answer is yes. We don't know yet exactly what that looks like, in part because we have to sort of peel back these transfers and understand the nature of that. And there may be different phasings that we go through. Maybe there are different ways to do this in phases. So we're working on that. We know time is passing us by. We know there'll be a new forecast soon, and your targets will be coming out soon. So we know that the pressure's on us to come forward with whatever ask we think we need to make. But I anticipate making an ask to help the university make that transition.
Representative Robbins. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is the right conversation for this committee, but to this particular building and this particular lease, I haven't seen any of the legal documents. I'm not an attorney. But it was my understanding from some of the conversations somewhere that the university has a 10-year option to renew with Fairview. Is that erroneous? Is that correct? What is that 10-year option?
Vice President Franz.
Mr. Chair, I am an attorney, but I don't practice anymore. I want to be careful here. So the agreement in 1996-97 terminates in 2026. Mm-hmm. That's the one that involves the buildings and some of the other activities. There's a new agreement in 2018 that is now coterminous with that 2026 deadline. So both Fairview and the university have, during the course of calendar year 2023, the opportunity to tell the other side that they're no longer interested in renewing that in 2026, and therefore the process unwinding can begin. But until that happens, at this point, Fairview and the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota physicians under the University of Minnesota are all working together under an agreement, and that's where M Health Fairview comes from, is that agreement that goes through 2026. So there are different other legal opportunities within that, but that's sort of the overall structure of what we're looking at right now.
Thank you.
Further questions, members? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick things. So back on the Heber slide, you had said it was a 3-to-1 savings. So we spend a dollar, save three. Just wondering again on that. You know, we hear that a lot. We talk about ROI. And can you just send me the source data? I actually have a son-in-law now that just graduated from the University of Minnesota with a biomath degree and a study in genomics. So he showed me his algorithm textbook, just one, and it's like this thick. And I said, do you know how to use each and every one of those algorithms? He said, I certainly do. So I'm going to be running it through, some professional analysis, because I'd like to see. You know, we get a lot of things said to us here at the legislature, Mr. Chair, and it's just nice to just check. So I'll be using the great University of Minnesota student who just graduated to run some numbers. That's one. And number two, I noticed it's all over Twitter that you have had quite a bit of changeover in the government relations at the University of Minnesota, and we'll be adding, former Senator, former Majority Leader Tom Bach. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that just really quickly so the legislature is fully informed as to how your government relations folks are doing right now.
Vice President Franz.
Sure, Mr. Chair. First of all, congratulations to your son. You should be very proud. There have been a few changes. So for some of you may know, J.D., Burton, our seven or eight years, had been working as our lead lobbyist for the university, has done a great job, has accepted a job at the University of Washington. And so we're sorry to see him go. I think his last day was last Friday. Mm-hmm. So we're working to make sure our teams are all connected and going forward on that. And I will be, let me make one other announcement. So Matt Kramer, the vice president for U Relations, will be stepping down and going to a private sector opportunity, I think around the 1st of March. So I will be coordinating with Vice President Kramer to oversee the government affairs during the remainder of this session. And one of the things we want to do is to make sure that we, have the right folks engaged over here, and we're really pleased by the work we've been doing. The decision to use former Senator Tom Bach as an advisor was something that was decided some time ago, and we've been getting his input on his advice, and we'll continue to do so. He's not an active lobbyist. Things are going on with the screen, it looks like. I hope it's not. It's distracting to me because I'm seeing all kinds of things flashing in front of my eyes. But so we will We'll continue to work out our team here, and but I'm going to be stepping in and having more active control during the rest of session, which may disappoint some of you, but we'll be we'll try to see what we can to maintain that right balance. But thank you for the question.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just wondering if you could let us know what former Senator Tom Bach is planning to do for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, he has really been advising us on sort of the overall strategies and concerns, you know, obviously with respect to things like bonding bills and other issues at the university. So he does what a lot of consultants do. He tells you what he thinks you should be doing, and we agree or disagree and go forward.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. And my last question is in regards to some of the regions. As you know, we're all taking meetings with different regions, both current that are rerunning and candidates. And I heard something that was unsettling. And so I just want to run it by you since you're right here. I had a current regent come to my office and say that he had handlers and that the University of Minnesota really encouraged him to have handlers. And maybe he didn't. He misspoke, but I had heard from another current regent that they were actually encouraged to, as regents, to not really come to the legislature, or if they did, to have staff with them. So I'm just wondering if you could just shine some light on that. Did he misunderstand, or?
Vice President Friend.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, I don't really know much, because one of the things I very assiduously do is stay out of regional elections. I mean, and one of the things that they're all very talented folks, very smart folks, and none of them need handlers in my estimation. And so to the extent they're using folks to, I mean, in order to coordinate getting around to see you all, it's a challenge. It's hard to do that because it takes a lot of work to coordinate to make these appointments. But I'm not aware of any recommendations about handling or not handling. I'm sure maybe they misspoke, but to the extent people help them get around, that may be it. But the regents that the current regents that I all know are talented, smart people, and they take care of themselves pretty well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that just begs one other quick question. So to the point of current regents being discouraged from actually coming to the legislature, and that was by the administration, I'm just wondering, can you just shine some light on that as well, maybe they misunderstood? Because I certainly think that a good relationship between the legislature and the University of Minnesota would be a good thing.
Vice President Friend.
Mr. Chair, Representative, do you mean all regents discouraged, or just the ones up for election discouraged from coming over?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of them. All the current ones.
Oh, I see. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question. No, I'm not aware of any guidance or direction from the administration for regents to participate in this glorious exercise of democracy over here. I don't know who would not want to participate in this, frankly. I'm actually being quite serious. I mean, we have our points of view and opinions, but it's such a great process. And so, no, I'm not aware of any directed by the administration to participate or not participate. The regents are such an important policymaking board, and to the extent they understand and are engaged, it just makes them, you know, more fully informed regents, which makes the university that much better. So I'm not aware of any of that.
Mr. Chair, one final comment.
Okay, thank you.
Just one final.
Oh, you have one more. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, that just everything he says just begs another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Not doing very
it's
well
not a question, but you know, I just want to. I'm sure on behalf of the entire higher ed committee, say we would really like regents, current seated regents, to come and talk to us. We have, you know, very little oversight over the University of Minnesota. They're a land-grant institution, predate statehood. We have two avenues, which is the election of regents, as they should be like a governing board, like we are here at the legislature, and to the person ring. And so I would encourage, if you would pass that information on, or maybe they're watching right now, encourage them to come and have a good relationship with all of the members of the higher ed committee. And we certainly want to encourage that the regents would come and talk with us. So I would say that too. And also the student associations, I know, have had challenges working with the previous government relations to set up meetings with legislatures. There's been impediments there. So I would also encourage a better relationship between the student associations, and the students want to come and talk to all of us. And I would really strongly encourage the student associations to come and speak to us. And I even offered to be that conduit to make that happen because they were not getting support from government relations anymore. And so, Mr. Chair, I just want to make you aware of that, too, that there has been some challenges there as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'm done.
All right. I'm going to request that the Budget Director Tonneson, can you come back up, please? And if you get the sheet that we had gone over on tuition, staff has pointed out a question. When you had done the presentation, you had said that the Twin Cities campus was getting a 3.5% tuition increase. And this is not my math, but it's because we have good people over to my right. It would appear to be a 1% tuition increase for the Twin Cities campus, not a 3.5.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. You found an error. Yes, you are absolutely right. I will redo the chart and send it to you later today. Okay.
Thank you much.
It's, yes, it is for FY24, instead of $140 for the Twin Cities campus, it would be $490. No, I apologize.
I want to thank staff, too, and that's why details do matter.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we're accurate. We can do
yes.
it.
We'll redo
Representative,
that
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. And just me being annoying again, I'm sorry. Does that mean the Rochester numbers are wrong, too? Because I believe we were also told that that increase was different as well.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, in our modeling today, we are still using a 1% increase for Rochester, but as I mentioned, the Chancellor has indicated that she will likely bring forward a proposal for a different rate increase. We just, that's part of our process. We're only halfway through our process right now.
Okay.
So all of the, and that's another point that I just want to emphasize, we are only halfway through our budget development process, so all of our variables could change. This is our current planning assumption.
Chair, can I ask a follow-up?
Representative Hitt.
Thank you. So if the Chancellor's increase were to be what ends up being the final, what would the Rochester tuition be then? It, you said this is at 1%, and they're saying they think they can sustain a larger one. What would that make their increase?
Budget Director Tonneson.
So if I'm doing the math correctly, just sitting here, Mr. Chair, and members, the $12,808 would increase by $420 in the first year. Hang on. And then by $463 in the second year if it was to continue into FY25.
Thank you so much for that.
And I will update for the Twin Cities for this document and send you a revised version.
And just to emphasize, this is if you get your entire budget request.
Mr. Chair.
If you don't, these numbers are going to change again.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Our current planning assumptions assume the full appropriation request.
Okay. Any further discussion today, members? We will not be having, oh, Representative O'Neill.
Just on a different point, Mr. Chair, if we're done with business with the University of Minnesota, are we about to gavel out?
Representative, I didn't hear that. Go ahead.
Oh, I said, if we're done with University of Minnesota, I just have a different question since you were just saying we're not meeting on Thursday.
I think we're finished with the university, so proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we had the Minn State system in front of us and we were looking at tuition student drops, I had asked if we could possibly have the Pine Tech College president come, since he had a 47% increase in student enrollment over the last decade.
Yes.
And since we're not doing anything on Thursday, is it possible that he could come and do a presentation? I know he has a presentation ready because he did it in the Senate.
Representative O'Neill, we are going to have that presentation, but it won't be Thursday.
Ah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's already in the pipeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very happy.
And we're not having a meeting Thursday. I would encourage members on Thursday to perhaps work on their regent meetings during this time. And no other questions. Thank you again. Thanks, staff. And I want to thank the university. Thank you very much. This was most enlightening. So with that, meeting is adjourned.